Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this past week, a few of us went down to visit Ruth Dennison, who's I think one of the kind of pioneer Buddhist teachers in America, just to visit and do some chanting for her. She's getting very old. She's 92, and her health is failing, and really unclear how much longer she's going to be around. So I wanted to go down and just give good wishes and encouragement, and just to do some chanting for her. And also for the caregivers who are helping to look after her. I mean, yeah, that's as we get older and more decrepit, then it's hard work to look after a human body. And I know when Ajahn Chah, as he was in the later years of his life with his illness and his being bedridden and whatnot, has it was a lot of work to look after him. So I thought it would be a good thing to do. Yeah, I mean, Ruth has fallen a few times in these last several years, and you know, kind of typical things of ancient aging body. Broken bones, and then long recovery rates, and then also just the minor strokes, and takes a toll on the body and on the mind. So being able to go down and visit, I think, was much appreciated by her, and I think by the caregivers as well. And it was interesting. We didn't spend too long, just because it's, again, not wanting to tire her out or the caregivers or throw routines of care into chaos, but just going down and expressing that kind of support and really a kind of appreciation for what Ruth is given, because she started teaching probably in the late 1960s, and there just wasn't much Buddhism meditation being taught in America. So that to be able to honor that, I think, is quite important. It was interesting to get to see her, and she has a kind of a indefatigable energy about her, very strong, very powerful, and she really wanted to impress upon us that necessity of, not getting lost, not taking happiness as a goal, happiness, joy, saying, it's not really the purpose of the practice, even though one obviously becomes happier, but that's not the purpose of it. And that the ability to really see through the different states of mind that we experience, and even if they're joyful, sublime, that those can be distractions and mistaken for the goal. So she was really keen. And I think it's, this is her human life is winding down, and to really point and really emphasize that whatever the case, whatever arises, that yeah, there is this opportunity for real liberation, real freedom, and to not mistake a transient joy or transient peace as something that is of real essence. So that it was quite wonderful to see, because she was also, you know, it's hard to a certain extent, she was kind of in and out of being able to keep a continuity of expression going. But that was the kind of the anchor, the core that she kept coming back to. And it was quite delightful to see that, and her wanting to share and wanting to give and wanting to encourage us. And so that seeing the end of a life of practice, that is real tangible fruit, tangible benefit. And as she said, you know, as she in her conversations was saying how, you know, the practice is not easy, and she's had difficulties, but whatever difficulties they were also just parts of the things that she has learned from. I think just as, you know, having been there and reflect and done that and seen Ruth and, you know, delighting in that opportunity, but just then reflecting on practice, reflecting on Dhamma, and how so much of our measure of what we think is the goal, of what we think in terms of what we, well, say, want to achieve out of the outer practice, is so much conditioned by the sense of self and the sense of personality, identity, and how much, you know, for one who realizes Dhamma, how much that identity and self-identity really completely falls away and is totally irrelevant. What comes to mind is, I remember when Ajahn Chah died, one of the great forest masters came to visit our community, and mainly out of concern for us as a community, to encourage us to maintain the integrity of the community, as well as to support us through that transition of our teacher dying. And the monk was Ajahn Mahabua, who's considered one of the kind of great forest masters. I mean, he has subsequently passed away himself. But at the time, he was probably into his 80s and still very energetic in teaching. But I remember him, he was giving a talk to, I mean, there was all of the monastic sangha there, but there was all the lay community there, you know, addressing the whole community. And he's giving a Dhamma talk, and then he stopped and he kind of laughed and took a drink of water, and then he said, "Oh, now that I'm getting old like this, whenever I give Dhamma talks, you know, you people really get to profit a lot." And he said, "Because, you know, in the old days, I'd start a Dhamma talk and I'd finish it." And he said, "Now I'm over 80 and I start talking and I forget what I'm talking about. I have to start over again." So I said, "You know, some, you know, it's like in the old days, you just come and listen to a talk, you only get one Dhamma talk. Now you're getting 5, 6 Dhamma talks." And it was really delightful, just sort of publicly sort of saying, "Oh, you know, I don't know, I forget what I'm talking about." And then being able to take it so that there wasn't a self-identification, there wasn't a sense of, oh, worry or fear, what are they going to think about me? Well, I've got to really hold it together so nobody thinks badly of me. It's sort of the, oh no, this is what happens as you're old. And, you know, your faculties, physical faculties, mental faculties just aren't what they were before. And that's how it works. That's part of the deal of having a human body and a human existence. So it's very kind of matter of fact, and it's actually really, I think, really important, because we tend to, of course, measure our sense of well-being and our sense of self-worth is around our identity, personality, as opposed to, say, value or essence. Maybe that's one of the words that came up when we were talking with Ruth and then also after talking amongst ourselves. This sense of essence is really what, personality, identity, intellectual acuity, all of those kinds of things. When those fall away, what's left? You know, there's all this essence, and the essence of somebody who has practiced and who has given attention and value to wholesome qualities, the virtues, the qualities of peace and discernment and compassion and kindness and patience. Those just shine through. You don't have to work at it anymore. You don't have to make it be there. That's what is the fruition of having given attention to that over time, over a lifetime of practice. And that's it's really important to recognize that the practice doesn't go away. Say like Ajahn Chah, that may have degenerative brain disease. And does that diminish his spiritual well-being or his spiritual essence? Not really. Remember a monk coming to visit Ajahn Chah. He'd been ill, and by that time he was really bedridden, lost all his capacity to speak and communicate. And that particular monk was well known for his meditative abilities, psychic powers, and he went and he came and visited. He went to Ajahn Chah's bedside, and he dropped into samadhi, into meditation. And after he came out, he said, "Ajahn Chah's mind is just bright and pure. There's nothing wrong with Ajahn Chah. It's you guys who got the problem." And that was wonderful. And that was when that monk, it was that monk who said, he said, "Ajahn Chah's mind, the nature of Ajahn Chah's mind, he loves to reflect on dependent origination. And now that his faculties are decreased, it'd be good for him to hear it." And so chant the dependent origination for him. So that's when I, at that time, was, of course, still living in Thailand. I was the abbot of Wat Nanachat, and I started a routine of going over every week on the lunar observance days to Ajahn Chah's monastery, taking a monastic community, lay community, and we would chant for him. And you could really see that hearing the chanting, Ajahn Chah really, you'd see him really settling, and it was affecting him in a real positive way. And there is something about the chanting, because one is, just all it is recollections of the virtues of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollections of teachings that the Buddha himself gave. So it has a very positive connotation, especially if you're Buddhist and you're familiar with these things. But that, again, that sense of what it hits on is things like the essence. So that in our own practice, how do we look after our essence? Because oftentimes we tend to worry about I had this terrible thought, or my mind is scattered, and I'm not as good as I should be, and my meditation isn't as peaceful as it should be, and there are. And obviously we've got lots of room for improvement on all levels, but we tend to get, that sense of identity keeps taking over, identifying with the mental states, and then trying to tweak the mental state so that we try to get as many good thoughts in a row as we can, because we're afraid of the bad thoughts, sort of thing. Try to get as many peaceful states as we can so we can keep out the unpeaceful. And a lot of it is just identity and trying to measure ourselves and forgetting essence. And so that sense of our cultivation of mindfulness and discernment, meditation, is being able to, obviously one is working with the mental states that arise, but it's important to be able to hold it in a larger context, holding it in the context of right view. What is it that, when we think of our life, our mind, our body, how do we hold it in terms of right view? And to be able to step back and view it from that perspective of, these are all impermanent. That all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. And whether we like them or dislike them, we approve or we disapprove, we want them, we don't want them, this is all. And you think, on a certain level, it sounds trite. Everybody knows that. But that isn't how we react to it. We tend to react, and we have something, we have a thought, a mood, and it upsets us, it worries us, it pulls us into desire in terms of wanting to get more of that, wanting to push away. That reaction only comes when we don't understand this is impermanent, it's uncertain, it is fraught with unsatisfactoriness. It's really not the basis to create an identity out of. So that sense of pulling back and saying, what is the view that accords with truth, and how to keep bringing the mind back, how to keep reminding oneself of that so that it's seen and understood. And this is exactly why the Buddha has us pay attention to the aspect within the Four Noble Truths. What is suffering? What is unsatisfactory? What is stressful? And that desire and impulse to try to get rid of the unpleasant and try to maintain the pleasant at all costs is stressful. It's unsatisfactory. That push to prop up a sense of self, this is who I am, and hope that by doing that we can prop up the bits of I am that people will like and they won't dislike. And this is this personality, identity. And say, well, no, as long as we're pushing and pulling inside, there's always this tension and stress and dis-ease. And it keeps the ball rolling. It keeps the attachments and clinging completely completely comfortable and happy, so that we're always out of balance, out of tune. So that reflecting on and encouraging the mind to how do we step back and hold it, our experience, in a way that we're according with right view, according with truth. And even if we even if we've got it thought out on an intellectual level, doesn't necessarily mean we can actually sustain that. And because so it's like when I remember somebody asking Ajahn Chah, the person had obviously, you know, thought their positions and their practice and their way of relating on an intellectual level, I got it all thought out, nice and logical and rational and intelligent, and then trying to get affirmation from Ajahn Chah that this was right view, and Ajahn Chah sort of saying, yeah, that's correct, but it's not true. So that sense, just because something's actually correct because it's well thought out, doesn't mean it's true. And this is where this sense of essence is so important, where we can come back to an essence of truth. And that essence of truth is always free from suffering. It's free from dis-ease. It's free from disharmony. I mean, that it's in tune with truth. So there's an ability to be present and at ease and have an unshakable foundation in truth without having to think it through or try to make it conform. And this is where so much of the practice is not about achieving or accomplishing or gaining particular experiences, gaining knowledge. It's about relinquishment and letting go and being able to recognize what is it that is necessary to be let go, what is it that is necessary to be relinquished. And so that when the mind starts to try to generate some purchase around that self-identification, it's just that relinquishing, letting go. There's movement towards aversion, irritation, indignation. Then there's that letting go, that relinquishing, being able to see, well, that is suffering, and letting it go, putting it down. It's not annihilating it, trying to negate and push it away out of aversion. It's just seeing clearly that whatever desire, whatever aversion, whatever confusion, whatever fear that one adds to the experience of the ourself and the world around us is unessential. It's not of essence. And it's going to create suffering. It's going to maintain suffering. So that willingness to relinquish and let go. And as we see that, that's where the ease and clarity comes from. We're tuning in and being able to relinquish and let go. And that's where, as we continue to relinquish and we become more skilled at letting go, what keeps rising is the quality of knowing clearly, that quality of awareness, of mindfulness, of attention, of being the one who knows. And that starts standing, shining forth. And you gain an intuitive appreciation for that the strength that comes from that quality of knowing. And this is where Ajahn Chah is so sort of adamant sometimes with us as when we were training with him, of putting the books down, paying attention to your experience. You know, obviously one needs some kind of structure and knowledge and understanding, but in the end, we have to rely on the application that comes through our own experience and that willingness to be present with our experience and then relinquish, to let go of whatever it is that's adding to it, that turns it into an experience of dis-ease, a bit stressful in some way, adding to its discontent, the mind's, the heart's discontent and dissatisfaction, which is where that when we're able to keep shedding, what is left is this tremendous peace and clarity. And it's not something that you gain or you force or you create. It's what is left. That's the essence that's actually left of the heart as we apply the principles of practice and the principles of Dhamma, not just in meditation, in our daily life. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.